It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk. Well, we have a tragic incident to talk about to start off the show this morning, and that is a little girl was shot in a playground area, basically. She was a 10-year-old little girl. She was a third grader at Clark Street Elementary School. And this past week, she was caught in the crossfire of what appears to be an apparent shootout. And this is a horrible situation, and a lot of people now are wondering what to do about this and if there is any sort of response that we as a community can have to make sure that this type of thing is minimized. We know it's unfortunately going to happen again because we have a history of this kind of thing, but what do we do to minimize it? And I came across a piece, actually, by James Causey of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Have you seen this piece?
No, I haven't.
Well, basically, this piece talks about how guns should equal prison. That is his thesis, basically. Guns should equal prison. Okay, and he talks about this in a way that says, you know, basically, I'll just summarize it, but that, you know, we have these gun deaths and we need to do something about it. And people who he also calls for, he wants it to be a felony if you unlawfully carry a firearm, not felon in possession of a firearm, but the alternative version if you're not a felon. And he thinks we should increase the penalties on that. And he points to New York as an example of a place that called for 3.5 years prison for somebody caught unlawfully possessing a firearm. I have a problem with this for a number of reasons. First of all, the reaction that we just need to pass some kind of mandatory minimum prison sentence for anybody caught possessing a firearm unlawfully is absurd for a number of reasons. It doesn't address the individual characteristics of the person. It doesn't address the circumstances. You and I both know, Kirk, that there are circumstances where people are carrying a firearm, but obviously doesn't lead to anything tragic, no death, no nothing like that. And this immediate knee-jerk reaction to call for prison for anybody who has a gun in these types of situations is foolish. And it doesn't solve anything.
Well,
it does nothing to do with it.
You know, I have to disagree, at least in principle, that when we have laws that are passed, assuming that it does go through the correct legislative process, and that, of course, involves someone on behalf of their constituents reflecting the public opinion on something, and they generate legislation that in turn reflects the sentiment of society. And if we as a society wish to state that we've had enough of this nonsense and want to do something about it, this is one legitimate tool in doing so. In general, I do not support mandatory minimums on anything because of the reason you just stated. But in terms of what we can do, this is the question. What alternatives are there? How do we, as a society, evolve to the point where we can actually do something about preventing gun violence?
Okay, and if this isn't going to do it, though, this is New York City passed a law that says illegal possession of a loaded handgun is a felony, and you shall serve at least 3.5 years behind bars. Okay, so let's play out the scenario. You have somebody that goes into, I don't know, a fast food restaurant, right? Like we've seen people do before.
Right.
Normally those people have concealed carry permits. Let's say somebody comes in and they've got a loaded handgun and they walk in there.
Or they have a permit, but it's a place that's designated that you
can't
carry one.
Exactly.
Like a bar.
Right. And they are frisked for whatever reason, or somebody suspects they have a gun and the police are called. They come and they investigate and they find a loaded handgun on the person. That person then is going to prison for at least 3.5 years. Granted, he did something wrong, right? He or she did something wrong. They had a loaded handgun in a place where they shouldn't be, but nobody was harmed by it. I'm not saying it's right. It is wrong, but nobody was harmed by it. Nobody died as a result of it, and yet we want to pass a mandatory minimum.
Well, the idea is, and the way
sentence?
It's supposed to work is that if people know it by, you know, talking heads like you and I discussing it on the air on a radio show, which is being broadcast right now to an audience full of people that are aware of the issue, and if this law does get passed, would be presumably aware of that law as well, they're put on notice that this is a big deal. Okay.
So do you think a gang member or somebody who's got a history of criminal violence is going to go, oh, now they pass that mandatory minimum law in the state of Wisconsin, I'm not going to carry a loaded handgun anymore?
Well, you're making the same argument as to why the death penalty doesn't work, and I agree with you. But the point is, what else can we do? I'll tell you what else we can do. Get rid of the handguns. I mean, that's really what we should be doing.
We have almost 500 million guns in this country. We can't do that, and that would be, in my view, violating the Second Amendment. And we can't practically do that. So what do we deal with in the situation we're currently in? Education, putting more money into schools, helping to educate people. All right.
But what about an education with regard to what happens if you're in a situation?
Great.
See,
That's
fine. The thing that I do think is at least a little bit I'm not going to say creative, but at least addressing the issue more directly. Rather than having a law that addresses what happens when someone dies, because we have those laws. We've already had them for, you know, basically since we've had laws. You know, you shoot and kill a little girl. Well, yes, you know what happens. But the point is, bringing the gun to the scenario is really what starts the problem. So in terms of going a little bit further than just don't kill somebody, don't have a gun when you're in that situation.
Well, I don't know. See, I would go back to the allegation is that this is a gang shooting. The formation of the gang would be the problem, right? Not bringing the gun.
Right, but just like many things, if it's and the person's charged, well, they don't know. They don't have the perp yet or people yet. Right. But would not be an intentional homicide. It would be a reckless homicide because they're engaging in activity which is virtually certain to create the risk of death or great bodily harm. Just like, we debate this issue as well, the law, the Len Bias law, that says if you distribute heroin to somebody and then they go off and die as a result of it, the fact that you gave the heroin to the person means that you're responsible for reckless homicide.
And the person, him or herself, is not responsible for, shooting up the heroin.
Right.
And it's the person who gave it to them.
Exactly,
they
like
have
a
no
gun?
Responsibility.
Isn't it almost exactly like a gun? Well, I mean, when you give somebody enough heroin where they can kill themselves.
Yes, it's a horrible thing.
It's just like giving somebody a loaded gun.
Right. Well, again, this isn't right, but we already have laws that prohibit the type of activity. Now we're turning it into a homicide, even though the person
himself
is the one who shot up.
Professor Hoff, what would you suggest that would be a better way than what we're talking about right now? I mean, we live in an imperfect system, right. An imperfect society.
Here is what I think we could do. Sorry, and I don't have the answers to all of these questions. But first of all, I just want to point out, gun violence is down in the last 20 years. It's not up. It's actually gone down drastically in the last 30 years. U.S. gun homicides rose in the 1960s. They gained in the 70s. They peaked in the 80s and the early 90s. And then they plunged and leveled out over the past 20 years. So despite most Americans believing that gun-related crime is higher than it was 20 years ago, it's lower, and substantially lower. Okay, so we start from that premise.
That's great, but ask this little girl's family how they feel about decline in gun violence.
I understand that, and it's tragic, but I'm just pointing that out. Secondly, Milwaukee actually, with the exception of a few areas in Milwaukee, is a safe city. And a very safe city, by the way. Most people have this perception of Milwaukee as not being safe. It is, in fact, safe, with the exception of a few zip codes in Milwaukee. And this was pointed out in an opinion piece. So this idea, I think a lot of it comes from media, right? A lot of it comes from this 24-hour coverage. But the idea that we're going to make things safer by simply increasing, I could argue that actually we'd make things less safe, unless you're talking about a mandatory life sentence for people. The people who do these types of things are going to get out. So gang prevention, talking about education for more gang prevention, talking about perhaps more police officers that are involved in the city of Milwaukee because budgets have been slashed and we haven't had a lot of that. I think those are much better solutions than simply saying artificially we're going to increase the prison population.
That's a great idea, Casey. Get out your checkbook because nobody else is going to pay for this. I mean, we should be allocating more tax dollars. But anytime you talk about funding something that comes into the realm of education or prevention, it goes nowhere.
But your buck is much better that way, isn't it?
We can't get enough assistant district attorneys in any county in this state to handle the workload, much less public defenders or people that are part of the system. I mean,
so you agree in principle that would be the best solution, education as opposed to simply increasing the prison population?
Absolutely, I do. But the reality is that when a legislator is trying to come up with an idea and start the debate, that's a good thing.
So rather than, what you're saying is essentially this idea isn't going to work. So we should just give up on the idea, or shouldn't we push forward and say, look, here is what we ought to be talking about. Here is the type of thing that can actually prevent more gun violence, and we have the statistics to show it. We have the research and the data to show it. So shouldn't we be talking more about that as opposed to just saying, oh, yeah, I think this is an okay idea and it's going to look good to the public to increase the mandatory minimums?
You're interpreting my argument incorrectly.
All right.
I'll put it succinctly. We should do everything we can to prevent gun violence, not just one thing or another. And raising the bar in terms of how seriously we take this type of thing, and that these idiots that are out there because they're in a stupid gang and they're like, I'm wearing red and you're wearing black, and they're shooting at each other just for whatever stupid reason, whether it's, you know, turf battle or, you know, I don't know, is it some sort of rivalry about, you know, something or other? I don't know. But the fact that that sort of thing goes on, and the fact that you cannot realistically ever stop the guns from being part of that, I've always believed, and I continue to believe, that we in some way have to get to the problem at the source, which is the massive and easy availability of guns. It's the easiest thing in the world for some guy in a gang to get a gun. And you know, something like this, that although, you know, I do fear that it has the potential to have a non-uniform application, like a lot of other laws. We've been through decades worth of realizing that the increased penalties for crack cocaine distribution versus powder cocaine distribution has had a very disparate impact on various economic and racial lines. So we got to take a break.
All right. Well, we have plenty more to talk about on the show coming up. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. Well, on a much lighter note, now that we're away from guns, let's talk about The Bachelorette, shall we?
Yeah, your favorite show.
It's a wonderful show. And
you actually do like that show, don't you?
I do. I do watch it with my wife, and it's a very interesting show. There's a lot of drama involved.
How long? Is it a half hour or an hour?
I believe it's an hour.
An hour?
Yeah. So
of
it's,
The Bachelorette.
Right.
And if I understand the premise right, people are like competing who gets to marry her,
to try to marry her.
Yeah, thank God I don't watch that show. Well, I would want that hour of my life back.
You know,
no one would be able to give it to me.
It's actually got a legal angle to
Kirk.
The Bachelorette, the current Bachelorette, Andy Dorfman, is a prosecutor at the Fulton County District Attorney's Office, or an assistant prosecutor, I should say. And she actually left her job to star on The Bachelorette. And she left in the middle of a murder trial. In the middle of a homicide trial.
Now, seems like her priorities are straight.
They are very straight. So she wasn't. Now she wasn't first chair in this trial. She wasn't the lead attorney on this trial, but she was an assistant on the trial. And her.
Well, what happened in the trial?
I don't know. I have no idea. But her boss called the leave highly unusual. That was his word. But he still supported her in leaving to go become the Bachelorette and to compete for all of these guys in terms of. Or
did
for
you
the guys
know that,
to
did you
for
know that they asked me to be on The Bachelor?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Years ago, when the show first started, I was asked by whatever network if I would participate. Well,
that would have been wonderful.
I said no.
Oh, you should have said yes. That would have been wonderful. No, actually, you shouldn't have said yes. You wouldn't have found your lovely wife today, so that would have been different. I take that back if you're listening. Now, there is word that also an attorney and former Bachelorette contestant, Craig Robinson, he also left his client, apparently high and dry, to star in the show. And now there's
So the point here is that people had jobs before the Bachelorette,
and they wanted this was a better
That's
job
shocking.
For them. Yes. So this is an interesting thing to me because attorneys, she's apparently going to get her job back as long as she comes back by, I believe her boss said, the 25th of this month.
Yeah. So she better hurry up. And get married.
The 31st of this month.
Oh,
so
better hurry up.
Yeah, so it's going to be very quickly. And her boss calls her a valued member of the district attorney's office, and he wants her back, and he's allowing her leave to go on the show. And I believe she gets paid for going on the show. All right, so
if I were her boss, I would just fire her.
You would?
Yeah.
Okay. Why would you just fire
her? For leaving in the middle of a murder trial. And when she comes back, she's going to be some kind of TMZ celebrity person that's prosecuting cases. What jury is going to take her seriously?
Well, do you think... Okay, so do you think that this is going to be a part of jury selection when she comes back, or if she comes back and they say...
Who watches The Bachelor?
And did you know that I was a member of The Bachelorette? Yeah, that I was the Bachelorette? Okay, all right.
Well, so when we have trials, the prosecutor always asks, who listens to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey? And of course, the entire jury raises their hand.
Well, sometimes.
Then I have to ask, well, do you like the show or not?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. So
sometimes they do.
Sometimes they do. Well, okay, so you think this is sort of devaluing her job as the district attorney?
Absolutely.
And you think that this is a bad choice. Okay, so I guess... As long as her boss is okay with it, and he's okay with her taking a leave of absence, I'm okay
well,
with it.
Well, okay.
Because
her
boss
is
the elected DA, right?
Yeah, and she works for the public. She works her tax dollars. If she's being paid right now, the citizens...
She's not being paid right now.
Oh,
she's on unpaid leave.
Unpaid leave. Okay. But
unpaid
the point
leave.
Is they're reserving a job
for
that,
her.
That somebody else should be doing right now. And it's bad enough that most, if not all... prosecutorial functions are underfunded. And you know, that's the politically popular angle, is that fighting crime and putting more resources into things is an important part of advancing our war against crime. So they've got an empty seat, you know, that's not being filled by somebody.
Her boss is okay.
She's off goofing around on this show.
But if her boss is okay with it, they apparently feel that they can handle the caseload while she's gone, right?
I suppose.
And so if he's made that determination and he's willing to hold a job open for her.
Well, what if it was something else? What if she wanted to go and sail around the world? How long is she gone, by the way?
Well, I don't know exactly. It's got to be several months.
Several months. So let's say she just wants to go, hold my job open for me. I'll be back when I'm done fooling around, doing whatever I'm doing.
Well,
it has
minute.
Nothing to do with my actual job. It's all about me.
Well, she's a young woman, right? She has the right to date other guys.
Sure.
And I'm sure there are other female district attorneys dating other men.
So let's say you came...
Is that wrong for them
to
do?
You came to me and said, Kirk, I would like to take 7 months off because I'd like to date.
Well, you'd say no.
I'd say no.
You'd say no and you'd
That's
and
my
I'd
point.
Be fired, right? But she's in a different scenario. And her boss is saying, I'm leaving the job open.
I think they're just all caught up in the giddiness of having somebody on TV, you know, in their office. That's all it is.
Well,
and
by
it's
the way,
stupid.
We probably won't have to worry about that because she's probably never going to come back, I would guess, because she's going to be on TV and, like you said, on TMZ all over the place. And that's probably what this former Bachelor contestant did as well. So,
well, do they end up, like, having a life in the media after this sort of thing? I thought they just get married and that's it. And then
No, not the end of it.
Okay.
That's not the end of it. Kirk,
and then they go out and do promos everywhere
or
something like that?
Well, enough about The Bachelorette. We have to get on to more important topics, like the dress code at Wauwatosa West High School.
That is more important.
This is something that I know that Kirk O'Bear is going to support because I know his position on this. But some students, according to TMJ4, want to wear short shorts to class. And these are particularly
Absolutely not.
Female students. Right. I knew that you would say this. And some of the students are speaking out. And according to this story by TMJ4, they're saying that it's unfair for teachers to tell girls to cover up. One of the sophomore students said, they're just legs. Is that really too distracting? I understand that girls shouldn't be coming to school with their butts or chests hanging out, but there has to be a happy medium. I think it's pretty unnecessary for them to try and make girls limit themselves because of what they think guys look at us as, said another student. As the rules stand now, girls are not allowed to wear shorts above a certain length or sleeveless tops. They say some teachers will make them stand up in front of their class to determine if their shorts meet the requirements.
Whose fault is that? It's the kid that wore the stupid short shorts.
Well,
you know, if you're talking about the risk of humiliation, stand up in front of the class. What does everybody think here?
Well, let me tell you what they've done now, though. This is the hook to the story. Many of the students have organized a sit-in protest in the main hallway at Wauwatosa West High School. despite the risk of suspension, and the participants wore short shorts, and they passed around a petition to change the dress code. They plan to take their concerns now to the school board. One of the students said, "We're in an environment where they teach us freedom of speech, freedom of petition, and to stand up for what we believe in, yet they're telling us they're going to suspend us for doing just that." One of the
Meanwhile, they should be doing their math homework.
And not where. All right. So you're saying, and I understand, and I agree with you, right? That it would be a distraction if you were showing your behind, right, or showing your chest in some sort of obscene way. But short shorts, as long as it's not showing your behind, right?
Well, first of all, school.
Your butt.
School isn't the beach. You're not there to kick back and, you know, relax or that kind of thing. You're there to learn, and I think that. You know, I do tend to have a much more conservative view on this topic than apparently most people do. And maybe it just comes from when I was in the military, I realized that, and I went through a time period when I was in high school. I didn't have a tremendous amount of financial resources. My mother was a teacher at a college, and much of our income was from grants and things like that. It was not regular. There were times when I could afford, you know, a new pair of tennis shoes. There were other times I couldn't. So, you know, I went to a school, unfortunately, that was very fashion conscious. And I always felt like I was inferior because I didn't have the latest set of Nikes or whatever it was in the early 80s or late 70s.
Well, and that is...
And it hurt my feelings, you know, because at school became more about what your t-shirt says or what kind of, you know, polo shirt you're wearing or whatever, that kind of thing, what kind of fancy sunglasses you're wearing when you're walking down the hall. But then in the military, everybody's the same. And interestingly enough, your individual merit is what comes through. Your individual goal-seeking and goal-attaining behavior. And you, as an individual that goes beyond what you're wearing, comes out. Instead of judging somebody else based on a glance at what they happen to have on their bodies. And I do think that sort of – schools are for learning. And they're not – it's not a fashion show. I think that allowing kids to wear just whatever they want leads to little cliques and people affiliating themselves with the popular groups or the not popular groups.
But I don't think that they're talking about wearing whatever they want. They're saying as long as they're not showing their
butts. Short shorts are too short. They're just too short.
But what is too short? That's the question.
If it's distracting. Look, we're having a debate about it right now, so obviously.
Well, 30 years ago, it used to be that you couldn't wear shorts above the knees. Do you think we should go back to that?
Well, 100 years ago, you couldn't show your ankles.
Right, exactly.
But then again, women didn't go to school 100 years ago.
Well, okay. And
I'm not saying that's good. But
there are certain cultures, right, in other countries where you have to cover up everything. You can't wear anything.
Well, and it's a cultural thing. So if this is something that we want to say our culture accepts another step toward inappropriate clothing, you know, which is what it is. That's what we're saying. Because, you know, short shorts are, let's say, for example, I'm not saying that going to school is like going to a formal restaurant by any means. You know, it's not like you should have to wear a tie to school. Although maybe you should have to wear a tie to school. I don't know. But the point is that there is short shorts are inappropriate in certain environments. And all we're saying here is that school is one of them. You know?
Yeah, but you have to define what is too short, and that's what I'm talking about here. So, all right. Well, that...
I might have more to say on this.
Oh, you might. All right. Well, we will be back in just a moment. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
We wear short shorts.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. You know, I can't let this subject just die. 12 minutes isn't enough for me to rant about short shorts, so I'm just going to keep going.
All right, so if you're just joining us...
It is Kirk and Casey, not Casey and Kirk. I don't completely dominate. You do most of the work. I'm just here for, you know, smart comments and wisecracks and that kind of thing. So
that's right. Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the Wauwatosa West High school students who organized a sit-in over the dress code at Wauwatosa West because they feel that they ought to be able to wear shorts.
Let me ask
shorts.
You this, because freedom of speech is implicated, and I know you feel very strongly about your freedom of speech. And how is it that the type of shorts you're wearing is freedom of speech? I just wonder what your opinion is on
that. In a school, it's freedom of expression.
Okay.
And in a school setting, I realize that there is a lesser expectation of freedom and also expression in the school setting, because we need to make sure that
it's a form of an institutional setting.
Yeah. The school needs to run efficiently. And there's case law on that, and I understand that. This would be different if it was just somebody walking down the road, right?
Right.
Although communities have certain ordinances that
not in short shorts,
but things that you can and can't you know, wear. I mean, businesses have rules that you can't walk in without your
shirt on. I wonder if Ben can find the song "We Wear Short Shorts," you know, that was from the 50s or 60s.
Oh, there you go.
Do you remember that one?
I don't.
We wear short shorts. And so the only reason is that then they used it in Nair commercials later. I'm just showing my age again. But, you know, the whole point of the song is that, hey, look at us. We're wearing short shorts. Ooh-hoo-hoo.
Well, my only problem is you have to define this, right? And you have to have what constitutes a short shorts.
I mean,
I don't know what constitutes short shorts.
I do. They look very short.
Well, that's a subjective determination. And are we going to get out the ruler?
It's just a little bit more it's a little bit more coverage than underwear, basically. I mean, it's along those lines.
Right, but what is a little bit? Don't we, as lawyers, right, are we always defining things? We're always setting standards, and somebody's version of something,
why could it be different. Why is it so hard for someone to wear a real pair of pants?
Well,
I mean,
in the 70s,
really?
In the 70s, right, weren't bell-bottom jeans often, I know they were bell-bottom at the bottom, but weren't they often fairly tight, right? At the top?
Yeah, and then in the 80s you had the Jordache jeans that were tight everywhere.
Yeah, so couldn't you make the argument that was distracting to students?
Because now we have those skinny jeans, too.
Now we have skinny jeans, right?
Yeah, I think you could make the argument that those things are distracting.
But we didn't do that.
But you know how I feel about it.
And
you know how I feel about it, Casey, so you're just setting me up to look silly. But the point is that I think that we should have school uniforms. I do. You know, a lot of things in the adult world, you have, you know, a uniform, so to speak. You go to court, you have to wear a jacket and appropriate neckwear. If you go to the hospital, you have if you're a doctor, you have certain clothes that you wear that are also not only utilitarian, but also appropriate for the setting that you're in. If you go to the opera, you're going to wear, you know, something appropriate. You go to a restaurant, depending on how casual it is, or if it's business casual, whatever. These are things that we as adults deal with in our daily lives. Why can't that be part of what we're teaching kids?
Well, it can be part of what we're teaching kids, but I'm saying when I went to a public school, I don't think that it harmed people all that much. And I know people have these standards and they have these views about things. Oh, things are much worse off than they were when I was a kid.
Right, walk uphill both ways.
Right. That's just, in many cases, revisionist history. Because we're talking, they really aren't that bad. We talk about things in terms of how they're always greater 50 years ago and 40 years ago and 30 years ago. That's not the case. We've always had things like this. And whether it be tight jeans back in the 70s with bell bottoms on them or short shorts now. And people cried about it at that time and they said it was going to lead to the destruction of culture and all these bad things are going to happen. But they didn't. They really didn't happen. And that's all I'm saying.
And you know, I hate to make generalizations here, but I do have to observe that, and nothing against this group of kids, hey, good for them for expressing their opinions and all these other things about a policy and letting their voices be heard. They're wrong, but, you know, good for them that they had at least the opportunity to say something about it. And that's the freedom of expression that I do support in this particular context. But you know what? They're wasting everybody's time, including mine. You know, that I'm even talking about it right now.
Well, then let's move on.
Okay.
We have another topic to get
to. Let's move on.
All right. We'll move on from short shorts. And now we have to talk about a resume of the Dodge County Sheriff. This is a very fascinating story. From the Fond du Lac Reporter, Dodge County Sheriff Pat Ninman's qualifications are being questioned by a former department employee. In an open letter to Dodge County citizens that was published in a Dodge County newspaper, former Dodge County Sheriff Detective Bob Newman accuses Ninman of using deception to gain her position as sheriff. Ninman will square off against Dodge County Sergeant Dale Schmidt in the Republican primary for sheriff in August. Ninman and Newman were the top finalists to succeed Todd Nails as sheriff when he retired last year. Ninman was appointed by Governor Scott Walker to fill Nails' remaining term. But Newman says in the letter that Nindman, this is hard, Nindman, mm-hmm. falsified the resume submitted with her application for the gubernatorial appointment by implying that she completed an associate's degree in criminal justice when, in fact, she was 6 credits short.
Now, how do you imply that you,
I'll tell you exactly how. I'll tell you exactly how what he's alleging. Nindman's resume is deceptive, as it attempts to fluff her qualifications, or she may have provided false information, Newman wrote. Nindman said Newman is misinterpreting her resume. All of my educational attainments on my resume had an end date, except for my request for my or my quest for my associate's degree. During my background check, I stated that my starting date for my associate's degree up until the present time. When I was interviewed by the Department of Justice investigator, I explained to him my steps in my educational process. At no time did I falsify anything. It's unfortunate that Newman incorrectly read my resume. So he's saying that the educational information, you know, right. where he put the end date, wasn't there. And he's saying...
The end date wasn't there,
and he's saying by her listing her associate's degree, that is deceptive.
I agree.
You do agree?
I do, because when you have a resume that's just – and a resume goes beyond just – especially when you're running for public office. It goes beyond just what you explain to the person who's interviewing you. It's a it becomes a public document that people can look at and draw conclusions from. And if you list associate's degree in criminal justice and then your sneaky little way of trying to signal to the world that you never actually got that degree was that you don't put an end date on, like it's an ongoing thing forever and ever or whatever.
Well, fair enough. But with all of her other other educational achievements, yeah. she did list
I thought about an end getting date. A PhD in global, you know, nuclear terrorism, but I haven't done that.
So would you have felt more comfortable had she put associate's degree and something like not done yet?
Yes, incomplete or something like that.
She had to list incomplete.
Or coursework toward degree that was not earned.
And I think certainly she could have been more clear. But the idea that she falsified this, I don't know that I would go that far to say that she falsified.
You have to look at someone's intent behind it. You know, what happens if you have a...
And if her intent... But
aren't resumes one of the most scrutinized documents in society? I mean, isn't these the things... Aren't we... don't we hold resumes to be one of those things that...
Yes.
You look at what kind of paper it's on. You look at the font. If there's anything that's spelled wrong, forget about it, you know? But... It's so the implications as well as and everybody knows that when you're listing education and you list degrees, you're not just talking about like one that you would like to have.
But according to her, when asked about this specific issue, or she actually provided the information saying, hey, I'm 6 credits short. I haven't completed this yet. I'm not done with this yet. So isn't that honest? I mean, when you're talking about that,
if it said that on the piece of paper, fine, because the entire public probably, right, has access to this resume.
Well, sure, it's an open record, and that's, I believe, how this the former employee got this, the former detective got this. But at the same time, if she's saying to the people who are interviewing her and who are going to decide whether she gets the job or not, and if they're saying, by the way, Governor Walker's camp is saying that they had this information – and that they hired her on merit. So
well, that's fine. I don't care about that. What's the important thing now is that going forward, there was, at least publicly speaking, as it's being represented, I believe there was an intent.
So it's an act of omission, right?
Yes.
And
well,
you're saying
it's
by
a combination
omitting,
of both.
By it, omitting that, she was falsifying the document.
Yeah, well, it's almost like, you know, I'm taking pilot lessons. It'd be like if I said I was a pilot, you know, on a resume. I'm not. I'm hoping to be one someday. But I don't just put, you know, pilot's license there because I'm thinking eventually I'll complete my requirements and have it.
Okay.
Because guess what? You know, this is something in the area of expertise that she's working in.
Right.
So if I went to the airlines and said, hey, look at my resume. It says pilot. And then, you know, American Airlines hires me and I'm flying a plane someplace and I'm like, wait a minute. I never actually got my pilot's license.
I would have a problem with that had you been interviewed by American Airlines. And I would imagine one of their first questions was, well, when did you complete when did you get your pilot's license? And you would say,
oh, yeah, what it says on my resume is false. It implies that I'm a pilot when I'm really not.
Well, what you might
do you think
say,
that cures
listen,
the problem?
I'm not saying that I'm saying I think she should have been more clear in her resume. And I think that she incorrectly put this, you know, or omitted certain information. But to go to so far as to say she lied and she falsified is to take another step.
Well, don't you think, and you're giving her too much credit, because I think that when someone represents the top law enforcement official in a county, you have to demonstrate honesty, integrity, good judgment, and this is a reflection of not having that.
All right. Well, we have to take a break. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. Don't we usually say Casey Hoff and Kirk O'Bear?
That was the last segment.
Oh, that
so
was...
we can say it now. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear.
Kirk O'Bear.
Just
all right.
That way we're
We have to get
consistent.
That correct. We're consistent. All right. So Mark Cuban, we need to talk about him because he has made a very controversial remark this week. And he was asked about this. This comes on the heels of the whole Clippers owner thing and all the horrible, horrendous, racist things that he said. Mark Cuban now is being asked certain questions, and when he's being asked about bigotry in general in our society, he says, quote, "I know that I'm prejudiced, and I know that I'm bigoted in a lot of different ways. If I see a black kid in a hoodie on my side of the street, I'll move to the other side of the street. If I see a white guy with a shaved head and tattoos, I'll move back to the other side of the street. None of us have pure thoughts. We all live in glass houses," end quote. That is what Mark Cuban stated.
Yeah.
And he said that basically when he was being asked. The context of that conversation is, and I'll go to another quote. He says, "If I see anybody that looks threatening, and I try not to, but part of me takes into account race and gender and image, I'm prejudiced. Other than for safety purposes, I try to always catch my prejudices and be very self-aware," end quote. So he's talking about these at some type of a conference, and this is in the context of a discussion that everybody's having in the country about race and views on race. And I have to say that certainly he's admitting to bigotry and prejudice, right? He's admitting to that. But isn't it better that we have somebody out here having this conversation in general than having somebody like, I don't know, Donald Sterling before this came out, although Donald Sterling actually did some really bad things in terms of discrimination against people in housing. But let's just say that Donald Sterling had done none of that, right? And he had not expressed any of that. And it hadn't been caught privately taped in a private, what was supposed to be a private conversation. Mark Cuban's coming out and saying, hey, I know I'm prejudiced. I know that I've got these views. Let's talk about this.
Well, and I
Isn't
think
that better?
Well, yes, I think it is. And the point that I would make is that when one can acknowledge their own, you know, the taste of prejudice that you might have in your brain that you don't like.
Right.
You know, that is at least identifying the problem. And it sounds like he's quite sincere in what he says. And this is these comments are not designed to inflame anybody. But, you know, it's the same thing that your hero, Jerry Spence, the great lawyer.
Right.
And for those of you that don't know who Jerry Spence is, he is a Wyoming lawyer, I believe.
Yes.
That for many years has established a reputation for unorthodox and very talented representation. He only handles a few cases. He's pretty old now, but he was the one that represented Karen Silkwood that they made the movie about, and also various other high-profile type cases. But he teaches on the way to address some of these problems that we have in society by means of trial work. And I went to a class that he taught, 15 years ago. And almost these same words were used in terms of how he addresses the jury. And in this particular case, he was representing an African-American young man. And he addressed the thing that everybody apparently was thinking about, and that is, you know, how do we deal with acknowledging when prejudice exists and when we have it. And we use that term prejudice in a lot of different ways. And what we're talking about right now is exactly what Mark Cuban is talking about, that there are those of us that might be walking down the street, you see a skinhead with tattoos, and if you can acknowledge that you feel a little funny when the guy's walking past you, then you're just being honest, okay?
Now, absolutely.
He's not saying it's a good thing. He's not saying he enjoys that.
Right.
And I think really the message here is, identifying where the problem is. He's not just saying it to say, hey, you know, hey, look at me, I'm prejudiced.
Right, he's not. And there are folks now who are calling for him to be reprimanded by the NBA.
That's silly.
And in the same way, certainly, if you look at...
It's a positive statement, I think.
Well, if you look at the context of his remarks versus this ridiculous Donald Sterling's remarks, okay... Donald Sterling's remarks.
He's exhibiting active prejudice that instead of acknowledging that he doesn't like the fact that there are stereotypes in our society. That's all Mark Cuban saying.
Absolutely. And when we talk about this, I think we have to have an honest conversation. I think most people in society have certain prejudice. I'm not saying racial prejudice. I'm not saying gender prejudice. I'm saying some type of prejudice against some group, right? Most people have some type of prejudice. We all come with them because we were all raised in society to, and certain stereotypes are reinforced.
Well, and then
so can we have an honest conversation?
And prejudice isn't good.
It's not good. It's terrible.
But let's not forget that what prejudice actually means is prejudging. That's the word. And it simply means that somebody has a general opinion about something or a general feeling. And this is where I think it's healthy and productive to identify where those stereotypes exist and where you, based on your own personal experience, acknowledge that you have some sort of prevalent view. Now, the good thing about starting that dialogue is that then people can understand that it's there instead of pretending it isn't. And that's way worse.
Many people have prejudices against lawyers.
Right.
Right?
Which is completely unfounded. You know, at least criminal defense lawyers should not be.
Well, some lawyers give the rest of lawyers a bad name. Right?
Right.
So
right.
In any profession, you're going to have certain people who are going to give other people a bad name
I'll give you a great example. What do you think... And I don't mean you. I mean anybody in society. When you say so-and-so is a Democrat or so-and-so is a Republican or so-and-so is a Tea Partier. I mean, you form opinions about what that person's like.
Absolutely.
And things.
Yeah, I don't like that because most people, I would say almost everybody, with the exception of a few... a few in our society are fairly independent on many issues, and we don't all fall into one box, and we shouldn't be doing that.
And some of us, unfortunately, do, you know, end up just going the party line. That's why we have that expression. But, you know, when Mark Cuban should not be disciplined in any way for being honest about an issue that is there. I mean, for you, I'd love to live in an ideal society where you could walk down the street and not have an opinion about a tattooed skinhead. I mean, let's just say, for example, and we've all seen these types of people, he's got like a swastika, you know, on his face or something like that, and he's, you know, wearing studded things. Freedom of expression, you can say whatever you want, you can do whatever you want, but, you know, if I'm walking down the street, I gotta be honest, I'd probably walk on the other side of the street.
Just because
that's your reaction to the type of thing. Now, that's a little different because that's a deliberate attempt to portray a particular image. But let's say it's somebody that's a different race than you. Now, I think that we all, as a society, have done everything we can, be in our school systems, how our parents have raised us, hopefully, you know, in the right way, so that eventually we can eliminate the differences amongst races, at least in terms of opportunities and at least in terms of how we view each other as human beings. We can all have an appreciation for, or at least a sympathetic view towards inappropriate views in our nation's past, including when the Constitution was written, where, you know, slaves were not people. They were like a portion of a person.
Right.
And continuing on the debate right up until the 13th Amendment was passed, where we as a nation still considered slaves, or at that point African Americans, to not have equivalent human rights.
Well,
and then as we evolved from there, and that wasn't that long ago.
Even if you listen to the Trayvon Martin debate, okay, and I think you and I tried to talk about that in a way that was, you know, non-controversial because we tried to analyze the legal situation. But there were many people who analyzed that, I think, based more on emotion, and it was an emotional case, and it was a terrible thing. But if you look at the polls that came out after that Trayvon Martin case, it was very, people were very racially divided in that case. And there was a lot of racial disparity, as there was with the O.J. Simpson verdict.
Correct.
I mean, there was a lot of racial disparity there. And I think, you know, part of the reason for that is because we have a society now where everything gets compartmentalized based on somebody's opinion about
things.
Well,
don't forget Rodney King, where that right. started several days of riots
right.
in L.A.
Right, and it's unfortunately seems to be heading more in that direction than perhaps it has been.
I think we are making advancements, again, as a society, because we are very conscientious about equality, and we're probably one of the best countries in the world, if not the best, at incorporating a variety of views
right.
and tolerance of other cultures and incorporating other races and cultures into our own, because you can't say what an American looks like, because it could look like anybody
right.
and that's the one thing that we have that's better than anybody else in the entire world. So you know, Mark Cuban here is really, I think, contributing to the betterment of the understanding of this issue. Because when people pretend that they don't have, and what he's identifying is that there's some source of this. It's not because he wants to feel that way, but we as a culture and as Americans still have these views that are formed in some way. And where do they come from is a healthy discussion.
Well, on that note, we have to end the show for today. You've been listening to another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. Have a wonderful weekend.